Chapter 13, Pharma's Best Friend, Bill Gates and COVID-19. In late September 2019, a few weeks before the first unreported human-to-human transmission of SARS-CoV-2 in Wuhan, the streaming service Netflix released a docuseries about Bill Gates called Inside Bill's Brain. The film's authorized celebration of Gates is calibrated in the manner of 1,000 other profiles from the last 20 years. Once a brash, restless, and perhaps overly ambitious genius, Gates has become philanthropist, philosopher, touched by humility, heroically channeling his genius and wealth into repairing a world in crisis. The series shows Gates crunching the numbers and studying the angles with darting eyes that feed the mighty processor of his visionary mind. If we are to survive climate change, the energy transition, and infectious disease, Gates concludes, it's important that we start deploying solutions unnaturally fast. A few months after the release of Inside Bill's Brain, Gates received an opportunity to demonstrate his commitment to historically speedy solutions. As described in the last chapter, COVID-19 triggered urgent planning sessions and international debates about the most effective strategies to defeat the first airborne pandemic virus in a century. At the WHO, public health experts met in February to sketch a plan to cooperatively research, develop, test, manufacture, and deploy treatments and vaccines. Producing and distributing billions of shots was a daunting task, but also an urgent one given the opportunistic nature of viruses to adapt and mutate. This conversation was informed by the hard-earned lessons of the AIDS, Ebola, and avian flu crises, each a showcase for how intellectual property and profit concerns contribute to artificial scarcities and inequities. No individual was better positioned in early 2020 to advance an unnaturally fast scale-up of research production than Bill Gates. Next to the Trump White House spectacle of anti-science incompetence, he arrived in the costume of de facto czar of global public health policy, a title purchased with billions of dollars dispensed by his eponymous foundation since stepping down as Microsoft CEO in 2000. Gates's influence over global public health policy is unique in its scope and ability to take different forms at different levels of power, from directing the budget choices of cash-strapped African governments to setting long-term agendas at international health and development agencies. He brought authority and sway with him into the offices of publishers, prime ministers, nonprofits, and pharmaceutical executives. Gates did not use this authority to support or even engage with experts and leaders from the Global South who warned about the dangers of leaving COVID-19 science in the hands of intellectual property-hoarding corporations. Instead, he threw his weight on the other side, working to ensure the pandemic response remained in line with the deep ideological commitment to knowledge monopolies that is a running feature of every stage and endeavor of Gates's life. In private meetings with drug company executives, government officials, and international health agency brass, Gates and his deputies affirmed their support for proprietary control and attempted to head off any discussion of pooling intellectual property or suspending the TRIPS regime. Instead, they teased a plan for pooling procurement orders. Alongside Gates at the front of this effort was Richard Wilder, a former head of intellectual property at Microsoft, who serves as general counsel and director of business development at Gates's flagship infectious disease research initiative, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, CEPI, a public-private initiative launched with Gates seed funding at the 2017 World Economic Forum in Davos. CEPI embodies the intellectual property-friendly philanthropic model that his organization would replicate in his attempt to orchestrate the global response to COVID-19. Early on, when governments and the companies were using a rhetoric of global public goods, there was space for Gates to have a major impact in favor of open models like pooling, says Manuel Martin, a policy advisor to Médecins Sans Frontières. He could have stepped up and said, "We're going to hold you to that because we have a moral obligation to turn a race into a collaboration where everyone exchanges information across platforms and subject areas." The Gates people dampened enthusiasm early by saying intellectual property is not an access barrier in vaccines. That's just demonstratively false. It's not the only access barrier, but nobody ever said it was. The impact of Gates' actions rippled throughout the radius of his influence in the world of public health, which is to say it left nothing untouched. "He has immense power," says James Love of Knowledge Ecology International. "He can get you fired from a UN job. He knows that if you want to work in global public health, you'd better not make an enemy of the Gates Foundation by questioning its positions on intellectual property and monopolies." On March 10, 2020, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation announced a partnership with the Wellcome Trust and MasterCard. The three were combining forces to seed a new mechanism called the Therapeutics Accelerator to identify potential treatments for the novel coronavirus that would be pronounced a pandemic the following day. An initiative that performed double duty as a social branding exercise for a financial services company chimed with Gates' signature management consulting approach to corporate philanthropy. An early signal, he would approach the looming global crisis with the same old toolkit. Those close to the debates taking place over how to organize the global research effort, debates that were beginning to unnerve industry, say Gates' timing was not a coincidence. Gates wanted exclusive rights maintained, and he acted faster than the WHO by announcing the accelerator and signaling business-as-usual rules on intellectual property, says James Love. Things could have gone either way at the time. Gates used his influence to stop the push for sharing the knowledge needed to make the products, the know-how, the data, the cell lines, the tech transfer. The CTAP pool would have included all of that. Gates's contracts with industry through the accelerator asked little in return and required none of the transparency that is critically important in about 20 different dimensions. Since the late 1990s, Gates has been telling everyone they can go to heaven by paying lip service to discounts to poor countries but still be selfish. Gates launched a larger version of the accelerator on April 24th. The Access to COVID-19 Tools Accelerator, Act A, was introduced as a full-service solution to what many were predicting would be a dual crisis of supply and access. It consisted of four pillars, covering health systems, diagnostics, treatments, and vaccines. The vaccine pillar, COVAX, was always the centerpiece. Officially launched in June by Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, a public-private Gates organization focused on childhood vaccination in the Global South, COVAX was conceived as a procurement pool and transaction hub for vaccines serving rich and poor countries alike. The plan called for CEPI to identify and invest in enough promising vaccine candidates to result in a portfolio of working vaccines. Gavi would then organize procurement and distribution through a finance mechanism called the Advanced Market Commitment, essentially a buyer's club that would subsidize vaccines to cover what the WHO calls the priority fifths, or the most vulnerable 20% of the world's 92 poorest countries. To cover the remaining 50% needed to achieve herd immunity, the countries would be left to compete on the global market. Launched to great fanfare by industry and Gavi's media relations department, COVAX was based on a faith that the market could be nudged and guided into balance between global public health and safety needs and the profit motives of monopoly-wielding companies in possession of the first WHO-approved vaccines. It also depended on rich governments, self-financing countries in the COVAX lingo, not racing against each other to close bilateral deals with manufacturers and thus leave everyone else staring at empty shelves. Both premises proved to be catastrophically incorrect. The Gates model assumed that production will follow demand and had no answer to the supply issue that the companies had no interest in solving. James Krellenstein, director of the advocacy group PREP for All, it was a dangerously incompetent plan that guaranteed the emergence of more variants as the virus spread. Within the first few months of COVAX's launch, the U.S. government signed 7 bilateral pre-orders for close to 1 billion doses. The U.K. inked 5 deals, giving it access to 270 million doses, more than enough for twice its population. The other G7 countries accounted for most of the rest. If the Gates organization had merely failed to anticipate the supply crisis or blundered in a good-faith attempt to deploy a technical fix to a fundamentally political problem, COVAX would amount to an epic miscarriage of power by someone who knew better. But the project must be judged on the basis of things far worse than a mere failure of planning and imagination. Gates personally sought to sabotage the efforts of those who predicted the scope and source of the supply crisis, and he did so while using every form of leverage at his disposal, including direct ownership of rights to actively restrict licensing and production outside the monopoly model. When the director of Oxford's Jenner Institute announced his desire to place the rights to its CEPI-supported vaccine candidate in the public domain, Gates intervened. As reported by Kaiser Health News, a few weeks later, Oxford, urged on by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, reversed course and signed an exclusive vaccine deal with AstraZeneca that gave the pharmaceutical giant sole rights and no guarantee of low prices. In the case of CureVac, a company that received more than $20 million from CEPI to develop an mRNA vaccine, the access obligation was removed from the contract without explanation. It's baffling, Public Citizen's Zane Rizvi told The Nation. CEPI helped jumpstart CureVac's work on the vaccine, but then seemingly waved away its own leverage to expand production around the world. The CureVac deletion was reminiscent of the fate suffered by the access obligation written into CEPI's original contract with participating drug companies. At the CEPI launch at Davos in 2017, much was made about the initiative's pricing pledge to hold partner companies accountable to the social values and mission of the initiative. After the media spotlight went dark, the companies decided the language went too far. CEPI dutifully watered the language down to a see-through gruel. Gates' use of contractual Potemkin villages to obscure his commitment to monopoly raises the question of whose interests are being served and how. Industry understands well that the details and outcomes of these access pledges get less attention than the fact they exist at all. As long as they and the organizations touting them exist, they serve to run effective interference for an industry that would otherwise be mute in the face of calls for more radical reforms to address the systemic failure that make access pledges necessary in the first place. This aspect of Gates' philanthropic endeavors was on display at the ACT Accelerator launch ceremony in April 2020, which featured a number of founding partners from industry. Thomas Quaney, Director General of the International Federation of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers and Associations, praised the initiative as a landmark global partnership, one that, as he would say many times over the next weeks and months, also happened to make unnecessary the consideration of other frameworks. It was the only thing that allowed Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla to waive so many questions about intellectual property away at the IFPMA media event and say, "The industry is already doing all the right things. We already have platforms." If Gates had used his influence to back the calls for pooling, suspending rights, and organizing global tech transfer, it would have snapped decades of dedication to knowledge monopolies dating to his vengeful teenage crusade against the open-source computer programming culture of the 1970s. In the 1980s and 90s, it was a novel use of intellectual property, copyright applied to computer code, that made Gates the richest man in the world for most of two decades, beginning in 1995. That was the year TRIPS went into effect, following an expensive lobbying campaign by an industry coalition that included Microsoft. 4 years later, Gates would arrive on the public health scene, checkbook in hand, just as his beleaguered partners in the TRIPS coalition were flailing in response to the global campaign to break their death grip on life-saving AIDS drugs. In May 1999, Gates was transitioning. Though focused on defending Microsoft from antitrust suits on two continents, he was in his final months as the company's CEO. As his business reputation suffered high-profile beatings from U.S. and European regulators, he began the process of moving on to his second act. In 2000, he would merge two smaller foundations into the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and commence an unlikely rise to the commanding heights of global development and public health. Gates debuted in this world during the May 1999 World Health Assembly. Big Pharma was richer than ever, but its lawsuit against the Mandela government had left it more hated than ever and more exposed. Despite a billion-dollar public affairs machine and a fully functioning echo chamber, it was bleeding legitimacy and appeared incapable of producing a mask resembling a credible human face. By every non-financial measure, it was an industry in distress. To borrow a title from a future Bill Gates production, you could say it was waiting for its Superman. In 2010, the Gates Foundation would bankroll a documentary advocating the privatization of U.S. public education titled Waiting for Superman. As the U.S. ambassador in Geneva rang the alarm over the future of TRIPS in the spring of 1999, Gates was preparing to launch Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, with a seed grant of $750 million. His billionaire profile didn't count for much at the raucous WHO assembly, and it was a source of consternation when officers from Gates' charity, still known as the William H. Gates Foundation, began distributing a glossy brochure touting the role of intellectual property in driving pharmaceutical innovation. James Love remembers seeing the Gates staffers joined in the distribution effort by Harvey Bale, a former U.S. trade official serving as director of the International Federation of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers and Associations. It was this nice full-color pamphlet about why patents don't present an access problem, with the Gates Foundation logo at the bottom, says Love. It was a little strange. I thought, okay, I guess this is what he's doing now. Looking back, that's when the Pharma Gates Consortium set the markers down on intellectual property. It pretty aggressively transformed the dynamics and perception of the civil society side of the debate. instead of Pharma versus Médecins Sans Frontières, it became Gates versus Médecins Sans Frontières. He's been sticking his nose into every intellectual property debate since. Following the 1999 World Health Assembly, the AIDS debate entered a new stage. Industry attempted to defuse the opposition and salvage its reputation by offering discounts to African countries. The compromise prices it offered were still obscenely high, but even this insulting peace offering to critics was too much for Pfizer, who stormed out of the industry coalition in protest. As during the first months of the COVID-19 pandemic, the more opinions swung against the drug companies and the better the stakes were understood, the more it seemed possible that momentum was building toward an overdue system-level break with the status quo. The movement was successfully building pressure for structural, more decisive solutions into the aughts, says Asia Russell, a veteran HIV/AIDS activist and director of HealthGap, an advocacy group. It was very focused, and just when it started to have effect, here's this new version of the industry narrative emerging from Gates and Pharma. It was still about how anything that interferes with industry profits will undermine research and development, but with a new dynamic. The same op-eds and talking points weren't coming just from industry, but also from philanthropy in the form of the Gates Foundation. The rise of the Gates Foundation and Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, quickly changed the perception of the conflict and its possible solutions, says Martin, the Médecins Sans Frontières policy advisor. When drug companies could just give money to Gates' institutions, it diffused the real issue of decolonizing global health, he says. The appearance of space between the industry and Gates as a third force was always an illusion. After the companies backed down from their lawsuit against Mandela in South Africa, Gates remained unhappy when a voluntary AIDS patent pool was set up inside the UN. Brooke Baker, a law professor at Northeastern University and senior policy analyst for HealthGap, recalls Gates' coolness toward the Unitaid Medicines patent pool, a pioneering voluntary pool seen by many as a successful working model for the WHO COVID-19 pool proposed in May 2020. Initially, Gates was unsupportive and even hostile toward the AIDS medicines patent pool. He brought that same hostility to relaxing industry's iron fist control over its technologies into the pandemic response, backed by his enormous influence, says Baker. It was a somber reunion of sorts when South Africa and India introduced a motion in the TRIPS Council on October 16, 2020, calling for the suspension of all IP barriers to COVID-19 technologies, including vaccines. A block of the richest countries rebuffed the request with the same ploy used by the drug companies, by pointing to Gates's COVAX. In response, South Africa demanded the partial contribution of COVAX be measured, not against a world without COVAX, but one without the IP regime that made COVAX necessary in the first place. In a statement circulated at the TRIPS Council in late February 2021, South Africa spoke for the waiver block and asked those delegations opposed to the waiver to recognize that a rather large gap exists between what COVAX can deliver and what is required in developing and least developed countries. Irrespective of the amount of money any of the donor countries may throw at the problem, the model of donation and philanthropic expediency cannot solve the fundamental disconnect between the monopolistic model it underwrites and the very real desire of developing and least developed countries to produce for themselves. Philanthropy cannot buy equality. The artificial shortage of vaccines is primarily caused by the inappropriate use of intellectual property rights. This cannot be allowed to continue. When South Africa delivered this statement in February 2021, 75% of all existing vaccines had been administered in just 10 countries. On the other side of those 130 million doses, close to 130 countries containing 2.5 billion people had yet to administer a single shot. The sporadic donations to COVAX turned out to be paltry. In some cases, they amounted to boxes containing just a dozen vials, enough to cover the occupants of a single presidential palace. The 20% goal set by COVAX, never sufficient, seemed remote. Prime ministers and executives continued to express rhetorical support for COVAX in the morning, only to continue signing bilateral deals in the afternoon. The European Commission had bypassed COVAX to enter into a regional procurement pool administered by the EU. Not even Gates' mighty media operation could stop the spread of growing public interest in the waiver debate and intellectual property more broadly. This interest led quickly back to Gates himself, who came to be on the receiving end of questions that drew out the old Microsoft monopolist, who now took the form of a vaccine monopolist, cloaked in the expensive costume of humanitarian visionary. The pandemic revealed the myth-making at the heart of Gates's multi-billion-dollar reputation laundering operation. His interventions to manage the COVID-19 response not only failed, they revealed the hollowness of his stated commitment to access and equity in medicines and vaccines. When confronted with the contradictions between his organization's stated goals and ideological commitment to inviolate private knowledge monopolies, he lashed out like a boy emperor. This version of Gates was distantly familiar to anyone who remembered Gates's first career. In interview after interview, Gates dismissed his critics on the issue, who now represented the majority of the global population in the poor South, as spoiled children demanding ice cream before dinner. It's the classic situation in global health, where the advocates all of a sudden want the vaccine for $0 and right away, he told Reuters in late January 2021. When a Fast Company reporter raised the growing concerns over intellectual property barriers in February, she described Gates raising his voice slightly and laughing in frustration before snapping, "It's irritating that this issue comes up here. This isn't about IP." Sometimes Gates larded his dismissals with comments equating state-protected and publicly funded monopolies with the free market. After New York Times journalist brought up the issue, Gates replied, "North Korea doesn't have that many vaccines as far as we can tell." The Times journalist might have pointed out that North Korea doesn't spend much on vaccine research, but the countries that do have produced most of the world's vaccines within public and nonprofit research environments. The more Gates was pressed on the issue, the more imperious grew his reactions, revealing his vaunted mastery of public health issues to be not just a mirage, but one manipulated to purpose. When asked by a Sky News reporter in April 2021 if he thought lifting intellectual property restrictions on vaccines would be helpful, Gates bristled. "No," he said. "There's only so many vaccine factories in the world, and people are very serious about the safety of vaccines." Both halves of the response were specious. From Canada to Bangladesh, owners of idle factories had tried and failed to sign licensing deals with vaccine companies, and further spare capacity existed or could have been built up in a number of countries. Many of these countries were already producing the vaccines that Gates insinuated were above the pay grade of developing countries to safely produce. Aside from the extreme condescension of this judgment, it conflicts with the fact, one that Gates knows well, that close to half of the 161 vaccines approved by the WHO, amounting to 70% of the world's vaccine supply, are manufactured in developing countries such as India, Brazil, Cuba, Thailand, Senegal, and Indonesia, according to the Global Vaccine Market Report. The difference between those vaccines and the COVID-19 shots has nothing to do with the quality of those countries' production lines, and everything to do with patents, trade secrets, and proprietary know-how. In May 2021, the stalemate inside the TRIPS Council was shaken up by the Biden administration's announcement that it would support an emergency waiver of some sort. Amid the political repositioning that followed, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation posted a short announcement by CEO Mark Sussman that stated, "No barriers should stand in the way of equitable access to vaccines, including intellectual property, which is why we are supportive of a narrow waiver during the pandemic." As discussed in the next chapter, a narrow waiver would not accomplish much and could be worse than nothing to the extent that it undermines calls for a broad waiver encompassing trade secrets and test data, matched with a mandatory tech transfer mechanism. That it took the organization so long to admit intellectual property constitutes a barrier at all cast a shadow over Sussman's reminder that the foundation had been working urgently since January 2020 on organizing the manufacture and flow of global vaccine supplies. Before that statement, the closest Gates ever came to conceding a relationship between IP and the supply crisis was during a January interview with South Africa's Mail and Guardian. When asked about the growing intellectual property debate at the WTO, he responded, "At this point, changing the rules wouldn't make any additional vaccines available." Gates's use of the phrase, "at this point," suggests he lacked the power to influence the debate when it mattered, as if he'd been living on an atoll in the South Pacific in the winter and spring of 2020. If Gates was counting on readers not to know anything about his machinations early into the pandemic, it was a safe bet. Most of the general public had more pressing matters at the time than following obscure debates about intellectual property. Of those that were aware of these debates, most probably thought themselves unqualified to have an opinion. Who were they to question the man they'd been told for years was the smartest guy in the room? Gates's refusal to entertain the possibility of a supply crisis and his rejection of those who anticipated in it full has not aged well. If any voices appear prophetic, they belong to the 140 political and public health leaders who first called for a people's vaccine. Those who do not remember the past are doomed to repeat it, reads the group letter published in May 2020. Applying these lessons, we call for a global agreement that ensures mandatory worldwide sharing of all COVID-19-related knowledge, data, and technologies with a pool of COVID-19 licenses freely available to all countries and establishes a global and equitable rapid manufacturing and distribution plan. Action must start urgently to massively build capacity worldwide to manufacture billions of vaccine doses and to recruit and train the millions of paid and protected health workers needed to deliver them. This was the plan that Gates did his best to deprive of oxygen in the critical early months of the pandemic. When the failure of his plan became impossible to ignore and public attention turned in Gates's direction, what people saw was not the quirky genius of Inside Bill's brain carrying the world on his narrow shoulders. They saw the entitled know-it-all monopolist of the Microsoft antitrust hearings. Turns out he was right here, working the same beat in plain view all this time.